Welcome to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan. This is the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. Some of you may be talking about Guns N' Roses. It's coming to Malaysia 14th of November. Now, some of you also might be talking about the possibility that there might be a last-minute cancellation. Now, your fears are not unfounded because we've had a history of last-minute cancellations and also bannings and some politicians going to the streets and trying to shut concerts down. Now, this is the topic of today. We're going to be trying to understand what goes on in the entertainment industry, the cost of shutting down concerts at the last minute, and also the long-term future of entertainment. I have as my guest Brian Lowe. He's with the My Performing Arts Agency and also Para Rajagopal. He's founder director of PR World. They're both involved in an organization called Arts Live Festivals and Events Association. They do advocacy for the entertainment industry. Guys, thank you so much for joining us this evening. I want to ask you from a kind of a business proposition. I mean, what is it in what does the industry mean in terms of business?
I think you know, it's a fairly significant industry. It generates about 2.8 billion a year in terms of
2.8 billion.
Yeah, economic revenue into the economy. It generates about 250 million in taxes to the government. Hires about up to 83,000 people directly.
I mean, these numbers, I know numbers are hard to kind of, I mean, many people think about concerts and festivals, think of them as intermittent. They come and they go, there's, you know, there's a lot of love. Are those numbers solid? I mean, where are you getting your numbers from?
I think it's very linked to tourism now, events. And, you know, there's two parts to it. One is the domestic economy, where you get hotels, venues booked, you get, you know, taxis, Grab, and all this. You know, it's like a step, when an event comes to town, it's like a shot of a steroid. And all this, suddenly there's a spike in all these, you know, economic circle that people rely on, merge, you know, venue, rental, and so obviously, the short-term effect is felt on the ground. But, you know, to get this big numbers, which will make sense for economy, how Malaysia will see it seriously, how the government will see it seriously, is that we have worked with PwC in the past with Malaysia Major Events, and they've put a significant amount of research and time, and the numbers that Brian just said, it's actually factual. You know, they create 2.8 billion worth of revenue.
Okay, I'm looking at you guys, and you look like, you know, you're not trying to sell used cars, and I believe you. The question is, who else believes you? Policymakers recognize the significant contributions of the entertainment industry to the national economy.
I think they recognize it to a certain extent that it's important. Otherwise, they would not have put so much effort into putting together bodies and policies and regulatory guidelines. But at the same time, I think they don't really look at it as a very integrated industry. So it's not just events. It's events and all of its ancillary activation points. One good example, which is the F1. You know, from the way we used to do it, it's always marketed as the Malaysian F1. And then the activation that happens around it was really great when it started, and then it kind of, you know, slowly dwindled down. And towards its last, edition, it was not really a festival, not really a spectacle. You just go and watch the race and you leave. On the other hand, when you cross our borders to Singapore, it's not really about the F1. You go for all, you know, the festivities around it, the environment,
stars,
the experience.
It's the experience. And now that's something that, you know, I read an article that interviewed you, and they said that there's something called experience tourism. Para, explain, what is experience tourism?
I think as the consumers become more and more technological savvy, and they obviously they can check everything what they're going to do when they travel, the hotel they're going to stay, and, you know, what they're going to eat, and how they're going to spend their, you know, entertainment outlets and the lifestyle that they prefer. So if we cannot match up with their expectation, and how Singapore and Bangkok and the other emerging markets that are like Jakarta and all that. So what can we also extend to them while they're at the state? So if we have like a big concert coming at the same time, when we did Bruno Mars sometime in May.
And you timed that for the general election, I understand.
That's another story.
I think I might
go to jail if I tell you the actual truth. These are the things that the young millennials look out for when they travel. They say, right. Hey, Bruno Mars is playing, let's stay on in KL, let's go. Yeah. After a few days, let's go to Penang.
Yeah.
And I have a few days off, So it's they want their travel to be a bit more experiential.
Okay, so they want more. They want to pack as much into their trip as possible. Yeah. What about this, the kind of hierarchy of demands now? I mean, what do Malaysians want? I mean, do they want the big concerts with the Bruno Mars's, or do they want the small, intimate theatre experience? And that's something that's also kind of up your alley, isn't it,
Yeah,
Brian?
I think the request is varying, It's kind of hard to put a clear answer as to what people want. What we think would sell sometimes don't sell. What we think won't sell sells out. So it's very hard to kind of determine that up front. But
do you see trends? I mean, are there trends emerging in the industry?
Yeah, there are trends, and then they defeat themselves in terms of the opposite trend. But I think the smaller shows tend to happen in KL because it's less of a risk for the promoters or the organizers to do it. The amount of financial risk involved in doing these things is minimal compared to a Bruno Mars, which is, if it gets cancelled, it could be fatal to the organizer in terms of the company.
The perfect segue to the next question is cancellations, last-minute cancellations, not because of the artists or things that couldn't be helped, but things that could be helped if policy and government got its act together, as it were. That was the reason that this association of yours, A Life, it says, yeah. like, you know, get a life,
yeah.
was came together. Tell us, yeah. Farah, what precipitated this push to come together as an association?
I think the number one is it was due to the height of the Future Music Festival being cancelled. And that created a big concern in the authorities, because they have not seen something like that before. The fans, what happened at the show, and the deaths and all that. So they are actually handling something they don't know what is going on. So the easiest thing is that they all got together and said, just cancel it, and do not allow anything with the word festival.
Was that their official response?
It's not the official response, yeah. But when we had events when the promoters go and get approval, and they say, okay, if it's like a jazz festival, they see the word festival, they say, okay, hold on first. We need to, we're not going to issue you permit so easily.
So a festival raised red flags.
Yes. Yeah.
Brian, why did you guys come together and set up this association?
I think because we wanted a voice. It's fine and all to have regulatory bodies trying to determine how certain things should be done in the country. And I think there should be always some form of regulation. But I also think it should be done in consultation with the people who are actually in the industry, so that you have a very rounded policy that's not too restrictive, but it's also an enabler of things to happen. It is in the interest of the organizer to make sure that everything is taken care of, from security to safety to food and beverage to artist experience. The whole thing is one big package that lasts only 3 hours. So the organizers really do want to work with all the bodies. So we felt we needed a voice. So we came together and said, even though in some circumstances we are competitors, but we are all basically on the same boat. So it's time to engage and have a dialogue.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And this dialogue is interesting, because earlier this year you had a dialogue called Enough is Enough, which is either a song by Donna Summer. I'm sure if I'm, plumbing the depths of my musical knowledge. Is it not Donna Summer?
Getting close.
Yeah, getting close. Okay. So Enough is Enough. What was the thrust and who was there from policymakers' side?
Let me just tell you. You see, the policymakers, they do not cancel this on their own. they have the NGOs and the political parties who hijack these events, and they create a lot of publicity to themselves. So they are safeguarding their political party or their interests or their religion or their race, you know. So they use that and they say that this is bad for the youth, this is bad for morality. So they use that, and so and the authorities, they are kind of threatened to make the right call, whether if we allow this, are we doing something morally correct, or if anything happens, who's going to be accountable? So they are also in a limbo, or to say, okay, or we have given that, we have given it, given the approvals, can we pull it back, you know? So this is where Alive comes and advocate to get the authorities to look into the details of the events. Do right. not get blurred by all these political and NGO pressures on making the
right.
Making
so the right cutting through the noise to get to the hub of it. Okay, we're going to be back. And if you know who sang that famous song, Enough is Enough, I'll personally give you a prize. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan. Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan. My guest today, Brian Lowe. He's with My Performing Arts Agency and also Para Rajagopal with the PR Worldwide. We're talking about festivals and the arts in general, the entertainment industry, and some of the challenges they've had over the last couple of decades. We were talking about a kind of a conversation that you guys had put together called Enough is Enough, trying to reach out to policymakers. Was it policymakers that was your main target? Or just was it a kind of an in-industry conversation?
I think that event was more of a statement. It was to say, you know, it's enough that, you know, we have to put together a show that's flawless in every single aspect. And there's a lot of burden that's on the shoulders of organizers. But at the same time, you know, it's really difficult for us to get things done when the regulatory effect is too heavy. Over-regulation was the issue. So that's where we did the overstatement in terms of enough is enough. Subsequently to that is when the dialogue started to happen.
Okay, and we'll come back to that a little later on. I just still want to kind of, you know, linger on the question of what happens to brand Malaysia when we have these bannings? Because these are often with international artists. I mean, the names are quite, you know, quite significant. I got like everybody from Chicago to Lamb of God to Erykah Badu to Linkin Park, who also, I think, were asked not to wear shorts. What kind of impression, image does it create for the country globally?
I think it's got significant impact on, you know, how because you see all these artists, they've got a lot of followers on their websites and on their Facebook, and social media is everything today. And if they Google holiday in Malaysia, and everything about Malaysia will come out, and they say, okay, or they're banning these. And also, it creates the wrong perception about what Malaysia is really about, you know, because this entertainment news will always be on the top of the search of the what goes on. You know, it's always the bad news will be on top, and you know, and all the other good news will be, you know, it won't even show up. You know,
well, so, okay, for some people this is good or bad depending on your own ideological standpoint, right? But let's just take the position that you guys have that in fact the entertainment industry is good. It contributes significantly to the national economy. It could contribute even more if we get our act together in terms of being a friendly environment for the business, for the entertainment business. But you know, if you could give us some sort of points of reference, for instance, are bands skipping Malaysia? Are they? You know, I know Lady Gaga kind of took exception to the banning of one of her songs. Are they saying, not only do we not want to risk having our concerts cancelled, we don't actually want to come to Malaysia anymore. We don't want to support a country that's intolerant of differences. Brian.
Yeah. I think it's not always that simple. They don't always skip Malaysia because of these ideological perceptions that they have. Sometimes it can be as simple as the fact that the artist fee is just too high. And it doesn't make any financial sense. The promoter offers a fee and it just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So the artist decides, okay, KL doesn't have the appetite to do it, so they'll just go to Singapore and then fly off to Bangkok. That could be one reason. The other reason is that sometimes, you know, decisions are made too late. they're already going to Singapore, and then they said, let's just do KL. And that's 3.5 weeks out. So to get an approval, you need a long lead time in Malaysia because of all the hopping and skipping required. So that's another reason why they skip. But very rarely, but it does happen in terms of what you just said, they do actually decide to not come to Malaysia. But
do you know any examples of anybody, artists, of skipping?
I think it's, you know, it's also the promoters. I mean, like an experienced promoter like me, I understand the sensitivity of the regulations, the country, the political landscape, you know. So we don't want to take financial risks and get those kind of acts, you know, who's got sexual orientation problems, you know, and maybe a bit controversial. So we might as well censor it ourselves.
Yeah.
And then trying to, you know, go against the tide and the regulation and trying to get this approved.
Okay.
Which will end up, you know, not very favorable. You know,
so your appetite for risk also, I guess, needs to be calculated against all these other things. But there is an issue in a globalized world like Malaysia, when everybody can, you know, fly, as it were, and go places.
Yeah.
Are we losing out regional? There must be the Singapores, the Bangkoks, the Jakartas that think, hey, you know, this is a great thing, and people will take a budget flight and see
Absolutely.
A concert. Absolutely. Who are we losing out to?
I think we're just losing in totality, you know. Firstly, Malaysia is a fantastic country. We have so much to offer as a destination. The food is great, the environment is great, people are just nice. Tourists do come here. We have 29 million, which is like almost the population of Malaysia. So it's a great destination, but we're not activating it with also, you know, these things. Whereas if you go to other countries like Singapore or even Bangkok for that reason, they're just totally invested in this idea of the experience economy. Get the events, get the artists here, and then let's do something around it. Let them stay an extra 2 days, spend more money. All this leads into an economic input and output. And promoters are at the front line of actually doing, making this change. They are the catalyst. So if you enable them and you facilitate them, you will see a lot of these outputs. So I think it's an interesting case to be made, I think.
Right, okay. So what about the issue of the consumer, right? The person who buys the ticket gets cancelled, he gets a refund, or he or she gets a refund. Are they sick and tired of what's been happening? Are they saying, well, don't bother, let's just, you know, save up the money to go to Singapore?
Yes.
Is that what they're saying?
There are many types of consumers. Those who've got a higher disposable income, they say, oh, don't worry, let's go to Singapore and watch it. You know, the experience is better, the venue is better, you know. We can stay one or two more days and then enjoy Singapore a bit better. But the mid level to the low level, I guess they don't have that amount of disposable income. So they tend to buy tickets early. Actually, like Bruno Mars and Ed Sheeran, we did sell out like in 25 minutes, 30 minutes. So I think the more events that we bring in and create the confidence in the market, I think the consumers understand that, you know, this is something that they can rely on, and you know, ticket sales is something that, you know, the promoters can also gauge early, because the Malaysia used to be a last minute market. Sales unit will come in like the month, 20 days before the show, or 10, and the promoter will be freaking out and say, oh, what's going to happen? But what's the bottom line going to be like? But if you bring the right content, if you have credibility enough to market it properly, and they, you can't fool the fans. The fans know. They will know if this is going to get cancelled or this is not going to get cancelled. You know, they know the kind of acts that...
Okay, they're pretty savvy. Yeah. I mean, I grew up at a time and in Singapore when acts were starting to come in. I remember the Boomtown Rats with Bob Geldof came, and I just could not afford the $50 for it. But when I grew up, when I got a bit more allowance money from my dad, I was able to see Bob Dylan and Eric Clapton and Ravi Shankar, all of whom were coming through Singapore. But I wondered if, in fact, the market in Singapore was really too small, because it seemed like the same people were going for the concerts, and, you know, you get sort of concert out.
Mm-hmm.
What is the market like here, Ryan?
Wow. Again, it's a very tricky question, that one. I think it all depends on timing, the ticket pricing and all that. I think Para said it really accurately. It all depends on the content. If that is an A-listing artist and the fans are diehard, you price it at 1,000 ringgit, it will sell out. But if you bring an A-lister and for some reason it doesn't sell out, there are many reasons why. It could be clashing dates, like Guns N' Roses is happening on the same day as Charlie Puth.
Okay, you know, I know Guns N' Roses. I don't know the other artists you mentioned.
I'll sing to you later.
So, you know, then, you know, fans, well, I hardly think these two are, crossovers. One is rock and one is pop. But, you know, we don't have as much disposable income in these days. The economy isn't that great. So you have to make a decision. So one of the promoters is going to lose out. So, you know, if the content is right, it will sell. If it's mediocre and all that, fans will just wait and they'll choose to decide.
It's the buying habit of Asians and Malaysians. Even they don't have money, they still want to buy a Nike or Adidas because they know this is for sure that what they want. So they will wait for what they want.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If it's not what they want, they say, we're not going for it. We're not going to buy something we're not sure. You know?
Okay. Yeah. So this is the business angle. It's your genius or lack of it or your experience that determines your success or failure. The question really is whether government is becoming a hindrance to you or the regulations are becoming a hindrance. And that's the subject for the next part of our discussion. You're listening to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan. Stay with us. Welcome back to Let's Talk, a show that brings you the most important discussions of the day. We're talking about festivals, the entertainment industry, how government can either be an enabler or hindrance, and also some questions about the responsibility of organizers, especially because the charge that festivals and entertainment of this sort often promotes unhealthy habits. Now, I want to come back to something that you said, Para, earlier about the future of a music festival. The festival didn't lead to the deaths, but kids who went there took drugs and unfortunately they overdosed and I believe six of them passed away as a consequence. And you said there was a bit of confusion as to how to respond to that situation. When something like that happens, does it damage the industry? Does it damage your ability to make the argument for the industry, especially to conservatives in this country who are genuinely concerned about, the lives of and safety of young people?
Yeah, of course. I think we can't blame the authorities sometimes or the public. They think that this event is, you know, encouraging people to take drugs. You know, and they've sort of stigmatized that music festivals are a drug party. You know, so they kind of have, you know, just call it short and say that, just cancel it because it's bad for everyone. You know, but they also fail to understand there is drug related deaths every day, overdose. You know, it can be in clubs or in hotel rooms or, you know, anywhere. So, but you don't shut the hotel down or you don't shut the clubs down. The clubs are still operating. But because the way events are regulated, where it's the police and the council actually gives you a permit for every event. So they feel they're accountable for that event. And it's their right to either approve it or not to approve it. So, you know, so in that case, they feel that, okay, if they cannot, you know, be able to control what's going on and how they can be accountable for it, so they might not be accountable for it, so they don't issue the permits. You know?
Okay, yeah. But to what extent is the industry taking on board the demands of society to be, you know, to perhaps make these concerts drug-free? I mean, have you gone the extra mile, bend over backwards to make these concerts drug-free? Yeah.
Of course, you know, at Alive, we even came out with our own code of conduct.
Yes.
So
conduct for the
organizers,
yeah. Right?
So we decided to self-regulate, self-censor. We came up with a book, a booklet that we distribute to all our members to say, you know, it goes from applying for permits all the way to safety, to drugs,
security,
everything is in there. Because, you know, sometimes I don't blame authorities and regulators as well. There are a lot of fly-by-night organizations. They come in and they say, okay, let's just do a DJ concert. And this DJ is going to come in from, you know, Indonesia. And they don't know about permits or approvals, safety. They don't know anything. And then when something happens, you know, the lens on something like this, it just magnifies everything. And it causes our reputation to be damaged even further. So we decided, we shouldn't just wait for someone to do it. We should take it upon ourselves to do it too. So we've took it upon ourselves to actually come up with a training program that we want to launch to say, you know, everyone who comes to Alive and joins Alive, you'll be taught how to do a festival, an event, and then you should be so-called Alive certified. So when you apply for...
Oh, so you provide certification.
Certification, yes. Which
you
is not...
charge?
It's not we charge for F&B. it does not include a concert ticket. Okay. But so that, you know, when the regulators know that these people have been trained, they don't have an excuse to say, oh, I didn't know.
Okay. You know? Parad, have the authorities appreciated the efforts that Alive has made?
I think they are very, very happy that we are trying to have constant dialogues with them and try to work with them closely. We are more recognizable now after 4 years. And in certain cases, we are the first one to go to if there's any, you know, concerns about events or certain promoters who are not Alive members and all that.
Right.
So I think we have made inroads with the government to actually understand our business a lot better.
Okay, so I think because the deaths and the drug issues are the kind of extreme end. Conservatives in this country are also against many other, kind of events on the spectrum. I mean, just the mingling of men and women could set some people, you know, up in arms. They're saying, no, we don't want that to happen. Mm-hmm. And I understand that even in some instances, like with the Black Eyed Peas, because the event was supported by an alcohol company, that, there were demands that you not allow Muslims to attend and only allow non-Muslims. So how does the industry view this? This taking away the choice of your consumers and citizens from sort of saying they want to attend a concert?
Well, it changes from event to event, to be very honest.
With a rating system for events as well.
A rating system?
Rating system. Yeah. Just like movies, mm-hmm. where you got the U for Umum, and then PG-13, and then 18. You know,
right.
So events with alcohol related is for 18 and above. So that's the drinking age. I think now it's raised to 21.
Okay.
It's raised to 21. So we did propose all this to the there's a governing body called PUSPAL, and I think they've got their challenges because it has to go to cabinet, and cabinet needs to approve all these changes in these guidelines and all that, but it's work in progress.
Do you have resistance from you? I mean, people when young people start listening to music? I mean, if you say it's the PG, I mean, you had to bring your, it's basically saying you had to bring your mom and dad. Mm. That's what parental guidance means.
Yeah.
PG, right?
Yeah.
Or 18. I mean, people are listening to music and they're 14. They're buying the music at 14.
It's available in their palms.
Yeah.
You know, so. I think sometimes it's counterintuitive to cancel a concert for dress codes or even consumption of alcohol when these things are freely available, either in the palm of your hands or down the street at a bar. So a more holistic approach needs to be taken with regards to content that comes to Malaysia. There are justifiable times where these contents are actually quite questionable and it should be cancelled.
Yeah.
And we actually advocate for it to say, I don't think maybe this one should come to Malaysia, but certain times, I think adults should be given the right to decide what they want to do.
Adults making choices for themselves. I mean, does Alive also want to become a censoring body? Because is that something that you kind of embrace as a possible function?
I don't think that is something
we want to do. We don't have the authority to do that because it's a governmental powers to censor or approve content.
Mm.
But we can give our input. Yeah. As an industry, player, with the members of all the industry players, and we can advocate what is right, what kind of content should be approved in Malaysia, what shouldn't be approved, and obviously, it's the decision of the body in the end whether they want to approve it.
Okay, we're going to come back to that very interesting acronym PUSPAL. I think that's something that needs to be explained. And if you haven't already sent your answer in, Enough is Enough was sung by Barbra Streisand, Babs, to some of us, and Donna Summers. So that's the answer. So no guesses, no prizes for any more of you guesses. Now, stay tuned. This is Let's Talk with me, Sharad Khatun. Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan. My guest tonight, Brian Lowe, he's with the My Performing Arts Agency, and also Pararaja Gopal, who's with PR Worldwide. That's his organization. They're both founding members of Arts Life Festival and Events Association, or ALIFE, as they like to call themselves. We've been talking about ALIFE for the entertainment industry, a lifeline. That's what we want. A lifeline for government, for the entertainment industry. A lot of red tape, and you know, having read around about the industry's problems, there's a lot of red tape. You mentioned Pushpal, there's also DBKL, there's the Immigration Department, which comes in and demands a bond. Could you talk us through some of the steps that that organizers have to go through in order to kind of produce a show?
I think there's two levels. The content approval, where the type of artists, the type of singers, the lyrics, and all that will be approved by Pushpal. So they've got like, I think, 12 bodies. They sit in a committee, and they approve this every Tuesday. It's under KKMM, Kementerian Komunikasi Malaysia.
The Multimedia Commission,
you know. So, but in that body, they also have police, council, but they don't approve the event there. The second level, when you get the Pushpal approval or the content approval, you need to go to where your venue is. If it's in Shah Alam, you need to go to Majlis Perbandaran Shah Alam. So you need to speak to the council and the police to get the event approval. So there is a loophole in this, because even if you get a Pushpal approval, the local council can still pull off your permits, okay. Or they don't approve it.
They can deny it to you.
Because they say the local community here don't agree for this type of content coming to.
Right. And what's the timeline like, Para? Because earlier you said that it's sometimes the last minute, 3 weeks, band says they want to come to Malaysia, and you said, well, it's just impossible to actually pull that off in 3 weeks. Seems like a long time.
It's actually, the timeline has been, you know, it's like a moving goalpost. Every time they set a timeline, and then something happens, and they use these timelines to benefit their own accountability. So usually before it was, you can apply 2 months before, and they'll approve everything 2 months.
But that's reasonable.
Yeah, that's reasonable. You know, and you've got your approvals, you got your papers. You know, you know you are safe. But since there's been a lot of controversial events happening, so the local council and the police, they kind of like keep the approvals till 2 weeks before the event. And so if there's any protest, if there's any, you know, problems with the content and all that, they said, oh, we haven't given the permit. So they are safe not to pull back the permit.
Right. Oh, Brian, what's your sense about the way they're thinking of these issues? I mean, Paris paints a picture of, you know, authorities actually being quite strategic. They're trying to give themselves some wiggle room to deal with protests and pushback. What's your sense about their values? Do they understand global youth culture? Do they understand that young people are already listening to these lyrics? And an event like a concert is just one moment in what is a lifetime commitment to that kind of music.
I think the regulatory bodies are very stringent when it comes to their own regulations. So, for instance, the police will make sure that, you know, it is safe. There's no riots. Nothing will happen. There's no protest. So it is actually within their purview and also interest to make sure it is peaceful. So in a sense, I also think that they are not enabled to make this kind of decision when it comes to content or shall I say, popular culture. They don't really care in that sense. They only care about the event. Is this going to cause a problem? If it's going to cause a problem, what do we need to do to mitigate that problem or risk? That's police. So when you shift the buck to the council, they look at it in their lens. You know, what is the community going to do?
So, right. But do we have a problem here when we talk about what's creating the problem? Because often people blame, in some ways, the concert for creating the problem. When others protest, people who'd never want to listen to that music, who don't want to see a Katy Perry or a Beyonce or whatever it is, you know, and they protest, what is the responsibility of the police? Should they be protecting the concert goers who are largely peaceful, you know, and they paid for the experience, or should they use the excuse of people protesting to cancel the event I mean, they keep the peace, but in a really perverse way.
I think the because of our political landscape and our the way our the landscape of Malaysia is, so I think their duty, they feel their duty is to protect the majority's sensitivity. So, you know, and if they think that the majority of them are going to flip if something like this comes to their community or the venue where it is, it's going to cause a lot of ill feelings, and they're going to get the backlash and say that, hey, you guys are supposed to make the right decision and you all approve something like this. So, you know, it comes back again that they're not doing a good job, and then they won't get the politicians there won't get voted back again. It goes on and on and on where this is going, you know. But
so how do we get over this hump? Because it seems impossible if we define the majority as essentially conservative. It's not clear to me that they are, because you could be conservative but tolerant of other people's choices. Yeah. Right.
There's very varying communities. People who are actually very conservative but also mindful that it's people's right to actually go and consume certain content.
Yeah.
There are also some people who feel it's their moral duty to actually make it known that they should protest on the streets to cancel the event. There is no majority or minority in that sense. You know, it's just contextualized by the content itself. But to a large extent, I think there is a lot of vagueness that has come into play, whereby who actually is the authority when it comes to content? Is it the police? Is it the council? Is it Puspal? Whose job is it to just go at one layer and say, I'm the content guy, this is a go, so dear council, please implement.
Okay, so
that's blurred.
Okay, so that hasn't happened. I do want to also take up this really interesting issue, which is that many of these rules and regulations or processes apply across the board. They apply for the big players and big events as they do for the small events. And I think it affects the arts in particular, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, I have a problem with this one.
Okay. I mean, tell me your problem. Let's talk, Brian.
It's like, you know, when you do a big concert like Bruno Mars, just the cost of bringing in the artist in terms of permits and approvals and deposits and fees can go up to 100 over 1,000 ringgit, all right?
Much more than that.
Much more, right?
No, there you go. Million.
So, and in that sense, if you think about that size of a concert, and you scale it down to, let's say, a busker who comes from Indonesia to play in a small cafe, let's say, maybe a Gaslight Cafe, where the audience size is only about 100 people, who pay 20 ringgit at the door. He is subjected, or the person who actually did the event, is subjected to the same red tape and same cost. So technically, if it's within DBKL's jurisdiction, you have to pay a deposit of 30,000 ringgit to bring one busker from Singapore to play in Gaslight Cafe, which to me doesn't make any sense at all. This is a problem because it impedes cultural exchange. It impedes the sense of, you know, livability and vibrancy at a community level. It also points to the fact that, you know, people just won't apply for permits. They'll be like, I can't afford this. Let's just not do it. So which is also the promoting the wrong habits and behaviors.
Okay, so they either just don't do it or they try to go under the radar, it is. So what you're looking at in terms of reforming the system, the regulations, is to calibrate the system so that it's sensitive to these differences. Is it just that the authorities have no sense of the complexity of the entertainment industry today?
I think that's exactly, you nailed it. It's too dynamic and too complex to actually understand what's going on, because by the time you do one thing, it's already changed. You know, the media is changing every day, you know, so, and, but I think what we should do is to, you know, learn best practices from our neighbors and how they have, you know, used this to their advantage. How event, like if you see how they turn around the Formula One in Singapore, and it's a landmark Formula One event, and why it's all so exciting to go there, it's entertainment. It's the stars that come in, you know.
It's the experience.
The boost,
experience.
Yeah.
And they even have high culture. I think they timed the Biennale for that as well.
Yeah.
Okay, Para, Brian, we're going to take a short break. We're going to be back. We're looking at the future of the entertainment industry in Malaysia. Can we change the situation, give a lifeline to entertainment. Stay tuned. This is Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kitchen. Welcome back to Let's Talk, Nishra. We're talking about the future of festivals and entertainment industry. We just got a snippet of the kind of bureaucratic tangles that organizers have to go through, or hoops they have to jump through in order to get their work done. Now, you know, you said, and I want to quote you in this article that you were interviewed, when you say, we want to make people happy. And I think happiness is such a underrated, you know, political value, you know, making people, allowing people to be happy. Let's talk about you guys. From the industry's point of view, what would make you happy at this point of time, Brian?
I think, you know, I want to see the vibrancy come back. Whether it's local content or foreign content, it should be a fact that people in our communities should be able to enjoy all sorts of entertainment within the limits and boundaries of what is acceptable. You know, so for me, I hope that we can bring back that vibrancy. So
did it leave? Did we have it, and did we lose it?
I think we did. Yeah.
And when did you know when we lost it, and why? Have you got a sense of?
Well, I wouldn't say it's just purely because of this. It could be, you know, the way youth culture has developed to just, you know, keeping themselves on the phone without actually leaving the house to actually experience anything. You don't see kids in playgrounds anymore. You don't really see children engaging that well with each other. So it's actually a larger cultural issue. But this is still one way for them to actually come out, enjoy, interact,
have some human contact,
and laugh and go back happy. You know?
Okay, so you could either go for a Bersay rally, or you could go for a Bruno Mars concert.
It's a festival.
Okay.
Bersay rally is free.
Okay, what's the low-hanging fruit? Nobody's making money except the water sellers and stuff But what is the low-hanging fruit for the industry in terms of change and reform? We have a new government, the new ministers, and perhaps the possibility of new thinking, in government about these issues. What is the low-hanging fruit for you, Para?
I think we changed the government on May 9th to actually aspire and dream for Malaysia to be an international renowned country. I think that's one of Villa. And I think the new government needs to look at various elements of economic income, you know, because we relied a lot on petroleum, natural resources. And I think it's, you know, the whole economic situation in the world, it's so uncertain, you know. So what is our assets now is actually coming to experience Malaysia. You know, tourism is a key driver. Even Singapore, they build the entire Marina Bay Sands, district, because they couldn't rely on the traditional Singapore economy anymore. So it's all tourism that's driving the economy now. But we've got so much to offer in this country, and I think Malaysia is underrated what exactly it can offer. So the image needs to be, you know, corrected. We need to really, you know, look at ourselves, what we can, you know, as a country come together and offer for people who are coming to experience Malaysia, you know. We're not saying that pop concerts are the only way you can experience Malaysia, you know, but I think we had Mariah Carey visiting last week. She came and she tweeted a photo of herself against the Twin Towers, and she said, "Good morning, Malaysia," you know. That created a lot of excitement for the country. So we are here to lend a superstar, you know, boost to the country. You know, we make it a lot more exciting and sexy. You know,
she's an extraordinary endorser. It's an endorsement
for nothing. I mean,
Okay. Yeah, so, Brian, if you could have a couple of ministers around this table and sort of exchanging ideas, shooting the breeze, who would you invite to this table?
Well, the first would be definitely the Ministry of Communication and Multimedia, Govind.
Right.
Because they are basically the custodians, or shall I say, the people that Puspal sit in. It's the ministry that they sit in. The second would definitely be the Tourism Minister.
Ministry of Tourism and Culture.
Tourism, Arts and Culture. The third would be the Federal Territories Minister. Because this whole you know, to change one thing, you actually need these three people to sit down and have a chat.
Just these three?
There could be more.
Yeah.
It could
be KDN
is another one
because there's police and immigration and all that.
So as you can see, the institutional structures are really big, and just you can't just change one thing in KDN expect the rest to follow. So you can't. The amount of lobbying required, dialogue,
coordination of acts,
just to change one simple thing. It's an astounding, monumental task to just change one policy.
Well, I think the best thing we should do is just get two NEM to come.
Two NEM? Because he said recently that he has no magic, right? Okay.
And he also said that he wasn't really happy with his minister's performance.
He did say that. He did say that. And that's the subject for another episode. But coming back to the sheer bureaucracy and the intricacies and the difficulty to maneuver. Now, some people, because advocate smaller government, and they say that what we should be seeing is governments shedding these responsibilities, devolving the power to local government or, to a lower level, or say, well, you know, let the market make these decisions. We don't need to be a nanny state and tell people how to think and what they should watch and what they should eat and, you know, and who they should dance to. Mm-hmm. Do you have, as an association, kind of grappled with the really prickly question of political will, Para?
We have engaged even to minister levels. And I think we had some success with the earlier government
to a point where... The previous administration under Najib Razak.
They kind of recognized the problem and they themselves have experienced how events can get pulled off and what kind of impact it's going to make. Mm-hmm. And with the current... We have also forwarded all this to the current minister, which is YB Gobind. And I think he's looked into it, but maybe he's got a lot of more things on his table. I think he's maybe our sheet is somewhere under all the...
On his to-do list. You're kind of loaded out of the to-do list.
Yeah, so we hope he's going to call us soon then, you know.
Okay, so short of having Tun come and sort of do magic, Brian, what can happen between now and the moment in which Gobind picks up that piece of paper and starts to deliberate on the kind of suggestions you're making? What is it that you as an association or the larger community can start thinking about?
I think we still continue to lobby, number one. We still continue the dialogues and engagements with everyone, whether it's people from the industry, the press, or even regulatory bodies. We're open to any form of discussions, and we continue to push boundary.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the only way to kind of get it done. You have to keep pushing at it to make sure that it happens. It's a thankless, painful experience, but you know we decided to do it.
Activists of happiness.
Yeah.
Activists for happiness. Yeah. I like that. What about the public? Do you think you need the public buy-in on this?
And, absolutely.
And who do you go to when you try to get public buy-in, Para?
You see, I think the public in general, they just want to go to the show. They just want to buy a ticket and go and watch their favorite singer or their favorite star or their favorite art, or you know, this is their way of escaping the daily routine of life. And if they get involved in the nitty gritty of what we do, it defeats the purpose of entertainment.
They probably won't go for a concert.
Yeah, they say if it's so difficult, you know, let's forget about it and just watch. Stay at home and watch TV and watch Let's Talk to Sharad.
Okay, but what about, they should be watching Let's Talk to Sharad, of course. But what about public pressure? I mean, if people, you know, said to their elected representatives, you know, think about this as well, that I am concerned about the entertainment industry. Would that help you?
I think it would. We haven't tapped on that arena just yet. These voices comes out usually when something drastic happens. A cancellation of especially their favorite artists. But in general, as an association, we have yet to kind of use the powers of public opinion to influence that change. But we're discussing it internally to actually start using that route as well. Because I think the public should have the right to
voice out their opinion on what they want consume to do or what they want to see.
And I think it's the duty of the government to also at least listen.
Yeah, but the question is, in a democratic society, governments often listen to the majority. The rig test will be is whether you have the majority, or at least a significant minority. Yeah. Significant minority is also very powerful.
I think there was a close situation that we had, because Bruno Mars was playing on the 9th of May, and there was a lot of noise because some people are saying, oh, you know, the show is going to be cancelled because, you know, it's election day, the government's not going to get a permit. But there was a start, came out with a good article, and they say that these are the points of people, and majority of them say that, you know, we'll vote in the morning and go to the show at night, you know?
Yeah absolutely, it's, no conflict at all.
Yeah, so that was on the star people on the front page. I've never made the front page, so this helped, I guess.
Well, there, you're a minor celebrity, like I am. Okay, thank you guys so much for helping us understand these complex issues. Yeah. I've been speaking to Brian Lowe and Appara Rajagopal. They're both advocates of happiness. That's how they call themselves. Remember, you can always join this conversation. You can email me at letstalk@astro.com.my. And keep watching every night at 10 p.m. Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin, only on Astro 180.